Hello, this is Sharon Steitler, the bird chick, and I am here with non-birding Bill.
What up?
And it is our goal to podcast about birds.
Oh God, is that what we're doing now?
So,
because I was ready to podcast about bauxite mining.
Okay, first, we've had requests. One of the requests is that we've had recently is someone has asked that
we stop.
No, even like the people that don't like my voice, they always like, you know, want it to keep going. I'm like, why are you listening if my voice irritates you? I don't understand.
I imagine because they're punching a heavy bag like Captain America in Avengers, the movie. And it just keeps them going until they, like, actually punch it off the chain.
Fair enough. No, someone wanted, we've had this request more than once. They want to know what we're drinking when we do the podcast.
Oh, boy. If only I could remember.
Well, we'll just say at the beginning of the podcast.
You ever seen, an old 50s movie where the pirates are lining up to get their grog? And it's like this, like, black ochre, this drink?
Most of the time, we're... In the summertime, I think we mix it up, but most of the time we're just drinking whiskey. But I'm having a gin and tonic, and I'm very excited because I put some lavender bitters in it, and that's just kind of thrown it over the edge.
Way to go.
I know.
I'm having a gin gimlet.
Okay. And we are drinking Beefeater gin for those people who care. But, yeah, it tastes like pine trees.
I actually prefer Bombay Sapphire, but I am willing to defer to... your preference.
My preference actually is Beefeater over the Bombay Sapphire. Although I do like Hendrix, the cucumber gin.
Okay.
But, I mean, in general, I'm always going to prefer Beefeater. But that's just me. I'm never going to prefer Tanqueray.
Oh, God. It tastes like butt. Tanqueray is nasty.
Just insulted a bunch of people.
I don't care. I'm sorry. I generally try not to be a cocktail snob.
But you're a snob about everything else.
Well, yeah, but if you like Tanqueray, you're not... I will drink...
Look, if Amy Winehouse sings about sniffing you out like Tanqueray, that should give you an idea of the quality of the alcohol.
And she's dead. She's a zombie at this point.
Too soon?
Oh, no, not too soon. All right. Are we going to talk about birds?
We are going to talk about birds, but I'm just trying to get things out of the way of things people... Also... I should mention we've had three people request the Jack Webb podcast.
We will get to that. That will be a special.
We are going to do a special edition Bird Chick podcast on the actor, writer, Jack Webb.
Producer, director.
Crazy pants.
Renaissance man.
Renaissance man about town.
Comedian. Singer.
Jazz fiend.
Singer. You are not prepared to know how much we know about Jack Webb, guys.
We're compiling
supporting character in Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, I have one of his songs on my iPhone.
Oh, I have several of his songs. You are really not prepared to know how much we know about Jack Webb.
So I feel like to do the Jack Webb podcast justice, we're going to have to actually prepare cues.
There are two government buildings in Los Angeles named after him and his production company. You are not prepared to know how much we know about Jack Webb.
And I almost had something to add to that, and I thought, no, I should save that for the Bird Chick
Jack Webb podcast. Yeah.
We will not talk about birds in this podcast, except maybe one Adam 12 reference. We will talk all things Jack Webb, so we'll make some notes. We'll find something that Jack Webb
actually drank.
We'll
bring something up.
Yeah. And if you don't know who Jack Webb is, Google him at this point. I'm not going to...
Oh, my Lord. Are you in for a treasure trove of rich... Let me say this.
Are we starting the Jack Webb podcast
I think
now?
We are. As much as there is an ironic component, but I legitimately enjoy, Dragnet...
Oh.
And the other things. I mean, he was just a dude who was, he found what was successful for him and he pursued it.
He had a very distinct vision. That's what I liked about it. And it was a vision that worked for its time.
Yeah. I really liked it.
And that's why they have tried to recreate Dragnet and Adam 12 and they can't.
No. My enjoyment of Jack Webb is not entirely ironic, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I really want to believe that police are like Adam 12, like, yes. Pete and Malloy. They're doing the best they can.
I enjoy Jack Webb in a Coen Brothers kind of way.
Right.
Because they create a reality and force you to live in that reality. And that's what Jack Webb did.
At the same time, we're really loving Orange is the New Black on Netflix. Which is the complete, like, I cannot even begin to imagine what Jack Webb would have thought of that.
Dude, we have kids listening to this podcast. We really don't need to be talking about
Orange is the New Black. There's no profanity in that. It's like...
Are you kidding? There's no profanity?
No, it's not like if you say Orange is the New Black, it's not like you're saying bleep is the new bleep.
No, no. But that's not what I would call a family-friendly show.
No.
It's a great show.
I don't think you should show your kids Dragnet and Adam 12.
You could show your kids Dragnet and Adam 12.
You could.
I watched Dragnet and Adam 12 as a kid.
So did I, but I'm not saying it's a completely accurate portrayal of what...
It's a...
Of what the 21st century law enforcement and life, you know,
unless
is
you're,
like.
Well, I'm going to refrain from saying that.
I really like the show. Allow me to restate. I really like the shows.
Which show are you talking about?
Both Dragnet and Adam 12.
Okay. And what does Orange is the New Black have to do with any of this?
I'm just saying they present different sides of what law enforcement is.
Kind of like Law and Order, pick your brand.
Salute your shorts.
SVU.
Yes.
Las Vegas. Oh, New York.
My only experience of... I never watched Law and Order. My only experience of Law and Order was the original show... I would catch the last 5 minutes of it while I was waiting for something else. I forget what was on after that. And it was always the bald guy who was in charge of the lawyers saying, you'll never get a conviction. You have to let this case go. That was all I ever saw of Law and Order. And it's like, fire this guy. Why is this guy around? He is pretty. It's like, oh, it was like Sam Waters is like, we got a confession. We've got videotapes. Like, you'll never get a conviction. You'll never go to. Yeah, don't let this guy. It's like, fire this guy. So.
Okay, if you're a bird watcher and you have not understood one single solitary pop culture reference we've just given you, you're watching too many birds. And you need to step away from the birds. And just peruse a Netflix queue or a network television station. Because I'm sure there's an SVU on there somewhere. Or a Law and Order. But anyway, you should know some pop culture things. You should not know as much pop culture as we do. But you should know at least one of those references.
I'm trying to migrate us away from talking about birds on this podcast.
You want to turn this into How Did This Get Made? Or what's that onion?
The Flop House.
Oh, the Flop House.
Oh,
thing.
Please. If you love bad movies, listen to The Flop House. It is the best podcast.
I'm
going to
start talking like that guy that I always hear you talking. Ooh, listening to on The Flop House.
Talking smack about Elliot Kalin.
That's pretty much what he sounds
He's
like.
He's won 3 Emmys for his work on The Daily Show, I will have you know.
And he wants to be a dentist.
Oh my God.
That's right. A birding podcast made fun of The Flop House. Come at me, Daily Show. Tase me, bro. Anyway.
Oh, okay, you were doing okay until you made a tase me. That reference was dated about 15 seconds after it happened.
People still use it.
Hey, Sharon, where's the beef? Oh, so many birders are slapping their knees right now in hilarity. Do we have any actual birding news to talk about?
Okay,
or are we just
This is from The Atlantic. And this is a story about urbanization, and it's about birds. And the house sparrows are on decline over in Europe. They're practically on the endangered species list. And I know people in North America are saying, why can't I just ship over my house sparrows that I don't want? And here's the reason why. There's quarantine, there's issues. I have a hunch that the house sparrows that we have here that were introduced... Since they came over on ships in the 1800s,
What up?
What are you doing?
I'm introducing house sparrows to America.
Stop. Okay, so house sparrows came over in the 1800s on ships, and back then it was not bird-friendly shipping. It was not really people-friendly shipping in the 1800s. You were lucky if you survived without any VD or scurvy at that point. Or God a vampire knows I attack. Was. Yeah. So anyway, so this is a very hardy stock of house sparrow that has landed in North America and just pretty much colonized every thing that they can.
Right.
Whereas over in Europe, you know, they've had they're kind of like upper crust, like,
house sparrows are actually an endangered
species. Yeah, and maybe it's because they're not the hard, bitter, urbanite house sparrows we have here. So anyway, we can't send them over because maybe our house sparrows have, like, maybe inbred and you just can't send things over. Anyway, it's a problem. So they're trying to create nesting habitat, and one of the ideas that someone has come up with is a brick that you can put in your brick wall, because they have a lot of walls over in London. Or not London, but in the UK. And you can put it in there, and the hole is just the right size for house sparrows. You know, it's not like predators can easily chew open the brick to make the house bigger and things like that. And they even have instructions for how every now and then, if you want to clean it out. The beauty of house sparrows is you really don't need to clean out their nest. They'll kind of take care of that for themselves. But if you are dealing with endangered house sparrows, then maybe you want to do that. And they show how to clean it out and things like that. And it's a cool idea. And so I'm thinking, why can't we do this in North America? But we could do it for chickadees and house wrens. And, you know, you could make it, because for house sparrows to nest, the hole has to be an inch and a quarter, because they're a beefier bird. If you want to avoid house sparrows but have only chickadees and wrens, then just make the hole an inch and an eighth.
That would require Americans to pay attention to mathematics.
Some Americans do.
And have birds nest in their walls, which people would freak out about because they're like, oh my god, we got birds nesting in our walls, that's going to lower our property values.
You know, that's not what's going to lower your property value.
Mm-hmm.
The crack house next door is what...
All right, well, why don't you start that campaign? That sounds like an excellent campaign.
I'm just linking to the story. You can discuss...
Has anyone thought... Here's my question. Has anybody thought about taking our American house sparrows and taking them back to Europe? To see if, our hardier, we will kill everything house sparrows can, displace the wimpier European house sparrows.
I love you so much right now because you just revealed how much you read Twitter while I'm talking on this podcast.
I didn't actually, I just thought of that.
No, I actually just was talking about that before I introduced the story.
I don't read your Twitter.
No. I was talking about it on this podcast that you're part of. I know, you just very clearly demonstrated that.
Yeah, I'm reading my own Twitter feed.
Yes, you are.
I not only have you blocked on Twitter, I have you blocked in person.
Marriage success.
Yay!
That's the secret to marriage. Not listening.
So what did you say about that?
I just went on and on about how it's not possible because of quarantine issues.
Well, wait a minute. They brought them. Can't we just smuggle them over?
Well, see, here's the thing is that, you know, maybe these house sparrows have evolved and they have immunity to diseases and are carriers now to diseases that the already weakened population in the UK aren't prepared for.
Brilliant. Let's go. Let's kill them off.
You are not going to be popular in this podcast.
That's how it works. No, that's how it works, is that, like, whenever you bring a new species over, it displaces the native species. Let's take...
You know what? Go back to listening to the Flophouse during the podcast.
Here's the thing. If we did that, would bird watchers have, this is the European house sparrow. This is the American European house sparrow. Therefore, we have two birds on our list instead of one.
No, because they're not separate species yet.
Yet.
Anyway... Try to pay a little more attention to the podcast.
Absolutely not. That was not part of the deal when
Don't
I started doing this podcast.
Don't poke the table next to the microphone. We're already dealing with sound issues.
I don't think we are.
Yeah, because we're using a different microphone.
Yeah.
The scientists are looking to revive... You know, I think we already talked about the story. The story just will not die. It just keeps coming up. So, essentially, they're trying...
Like bird watchers.
They're trying to de-extinct the passenger pigeon.
Huh.
And what annoys me most about this is the word de-extinct.
De-stinct?
They're not just we're reversing extinction. We're de-extinctioning. We're gonna get all de-extinction on this bird.
We have a similar word in English that might interest
in
you.
Yeah.
Called reintroduce.
No. Because reintroduce implies that you have something that isn't obliterated off the planet.
There is no one who wants the passenger pigeon back.
Oh, there are a lot of people who want passenger pigeons
back.
No, there's...
Back. Okay, let me rephrase this. There is no one who is not a bird watcher who wants the passenger pigeon back.
No, I think
passenger pigeon was a pest bird.
You know, when they talk about shooting clay birds, you know, you and I have gone out to shoot clay birds.
Oh, yeah.
The reason why they're called clay birds...
Yes.
...is because they used to not... They used to just have boxes of passenger pigeons that they were hoping and people would shoot.
No, they don't want them back. They ate crops.
They ate acorns.
Yeah. They're extinct because people hunted them to extinction.
Well, there were a couple of reasons. It wasn't necessarily that they were eating crops. It was that they lived in these gigantic flocks and they would kind of come back to the same area even when their flock mates were being shot. And they were constantly on the move and they had a really, from what I understand, a fast breeding pattern. So they would go to where there would be like a lot of oak mast and they would just eat the crap out of the oak mast and they would even breed in there. And because all of them would be concentrated, oh, and I should probably mention, oak mast is... You know, not every year acorns fall off an oak tree. Some years you'll just have, like, a bunch of oak trees drop a bunch of acorns, and so that's the mast. It's this concentration of acorns. So that's where the passenger pigeons would go. And I read this article from the Bell Museum of Natural History. Gosh, I think I read this article about 10 years ago. And it traced... And it talked about oak mast and the animals that you find going around to eat oak mast. And it talked about how passenger pigeons would come and they ate up the leftover acorns so quickly that they didn't hang around. The acorns didn't rot on the ground for a while. And now that we don't have the passenger pigeon, the other animals have to eat it. So you have mice eating it. You have turkeys eating it. You have deer eating it. And they don't eat it as quickly as the passenger pigeon. And so because you have deer and mice kind of hanging out together for longer periods of time, that's this whole breeding ground of Lyme disease. And they talked about how you did not see, you could line up Lyme disease appearance in North America and an increase in cases with the extinction of the passenger pigeon. Now, it wasn't a foolproof article because the weird thing about Lyme disease, if you've ever been lucky enough to have it or know someone who has had it, it's
lucky.
Not... I use that facetiously. It's not easy to diagnose because it looks like a lot of other things. So we don't know if people have had Lyme disease before and the symptoms were just weird. But it was a really fascinating article and made a good case that Lyme disease is more prevalent now because of the extinction of the passenger pigeon.
All right. So we want to bring the passenger pigeon back.
Yeah, but the idea, it comes directly from Jurassic Park, in which dinosaur DNA...
Where everything turned out okay.
I know, spared no expense. Dinosaur DNA was filled with corresponding fragments from living amphibians, birds, and reptiles. Working with Church's lab and Bess Shapiro in evolutionary biology from the University of California, Santa Cruz, Novak plans to use passenger pigeon DNA taken from museum specimens to fill in the blanks with fragments of band-tailed pigeons.
You really went far too long trying to do an animated character from the middle of the Jurassic Park movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you just... Okay, fair enough. You just acknowledged that, yes. So.
Why don't you just keep reading your phone, sweetheart?
Well,
because
I have a really interesting
going.
Story to bring up at the end of this podcast.
Okay, so basically what they're going to do is they're going to use the reconstituted genome.
They're not. This isn't going to happen. It's not going to work.
It would be inserted into a band-tailed pigeon stem cell.
It won't work.
Which would transform into a germ cell.
Won't work.
Which is the precursor of egg and sperm.
Will not happen.
Moose and squirrel.
Yes.
And then the scientists would inject these germ cells into developing band-tailed pigeons.
For a bird that no one wants to see, except bird watchers.
As the bird's mate, their eventual offspring would express the passenger pigeon genes, coming as close to being a passenger pigeon as the available genetic material allows.
Won't happen, and even if it does, the American Birdwatching Association will not recognize it as the passenger pigeon.
You know what's
going
to happen is it's gonna go crazy. It's going to get loose, and then it's just
going to... It's going to mutate into a bird that eats human eyes and will attack humans.
But the birds got smarter.
Exactly.
What is that movie where the sharks got smarter?
Deep Blue Sea.
That's it. Yes, that's what's going to happen. We're going to have Deep Blue Sky.
Here's my problem, is that scientists apparently have never seen any movie ever. This is my reaction.
Some scientists has, because Neil...
Has?
...deGrasse Tyson is redoing Cosmos.
Well, that's a really cool series. It's like these stories that you hear about, oh, these scientists have decided to, you know, drill into a lake that the bacteria has been sealed for 200 years. Have you never seen a movie? This will end poorly.
In fairness, a lot of the science in movies is pretty shoddy.
Mm. You know, I'm often walking around and thinking, oh, if only a passenger pigeon was around.
We have band-tailed pigeons.
Is that your passenger pigeon call?
No, actually, I was doing a Eurasian collared dove. And just like actually, I was not doing any bird call because my goal is to never publicly do bird
just
calls
like a passenger,
that's sideshow freak stuff.
Just like a passenger pigeon calls sound song
ooh,
like
baby,
sounds like singing.
Ooh, baby, ooh.
Yeah.
Ew.
Do we have another story? I'm really
you
tired of talking
about you
said
you had another story, so
I'm... Oh, this is... I'm saving that for the end, because I've only got a paragraph, because I'm not really... I'm not willing to pay to talk about this.
All right, so I'm linking to a story with kestrels and their amazing eating ability.
Okay.
This comes from Audubon Magazine, and people who banned American kestrels in Oregon have taken photos of the nestlings when they're in the box, and they go in to ban them. And apparently sometimes they go in there and the birds have half-eaten things hanging out of their mouth. And so the article talks about how, you know, this isn't a bad thing, because here we have a kestrel with like a half-eaten snake, and it still has quite a bit of snake
now,
to eat.
I assume this is something the parent has brought to it to
eat?
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And birds of prey have this kind of like weird hooked tongue.
Right.
It's like they have kind of like this hook that points to the back of their mouth. And so they can kind of swallow and digest. There was a video a while ago from Sparky Stensis in Saxon Bog where it was a brown thrasher eating a snake. And the chick was like taking forever to eat the snake because the parent brought out this big snake. Who knew brown thrashers would eat small snakes? But they do. Yeah. But... And just talking about how, yeah, all the chicks fled from the nest, so they know that the birds kind of eat the snakes. But the way birds' mouths are shaped, they can kind of just have something in there for several hours and still breathe. And it might be a little
Okay, so the birds... Because there's the rather famous video of four owl chicks, and one of them is trying to choke down a rat, mm-hmm. while the other, you know... So these birds are okay with this?
That's
I mean, that's the weird thing about birds is that they can't bite. They have to swallow things whole.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, some birds, yes.
What birds can bite?
Well, you know, if you're a bird with a really sharp beak. Okay, so, like, hawks tend to rip and shred.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, I understand that, because I've seen this while you were working at the Raptor Center, and you had... They would, like, tear apart stuff, but I'm looking at these... You know, young birds that have, like, a whole animal that is somewhat longer than the actual bird. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, this bird hasn't learned to take bite-sized things. This bird is trying to swallow the whole thing whole.
They're just saying that, you know, because they find... They don't try to remove the animals, mm-hmm. and the birds all seem to do fine. So,
okay.
Anyway,
all right.
Just, if you want to see... Photos of little tiny kestrels with really big things lodged in their mouth.
Is this a thing like... Okay, here's the thing. I think we've talked about this before. Like, first-year ducks aren't good parents.
Yes.
And, like, you know, typically you see them, like, they only have one duckling. It's because something has eaten them.
Well, yeah, bass, turtles.
Is there any study about, like, first-year raptors where it's like, oh, I tried to feed my chick a whole snake. And it didn't survive. Do they learn how to become better parents over successive years?
I don't know if they... And here's here's a really crazy thing, because I've been reading a lot of stuff about peregrine falcon parentage and things like that. They're surprisingly on the ball parents, and maybe it's because it generally takes them a couple years of them surviving
just to
on their
survive
own,
on their own?
Okay. Before they have kids. But
and they're the chicks that have survived parents that were successful parents. Okay.
But, you know, what's really fascinating is with some of these birds, like in the case of peregrine falcons, the male and female have assigned duties. So with peregrine falcons, the male's job is just to bring stuff back to the nest.
Right.
So if the chicks, let's say, once... I know it's true for the first week. I don't know if it's true beyond the first week. But when they first hatch, the chicks cannot swallow big chunks of meat. And so,
sure.
But only the female will tear apart little pieces of meat to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if something happens to the female in the chick's first week, possibly second week of life, the male is just going to keep bringing food. But the chicks aren't going to know how to eat it. And there have been cases of the male, like... They're dead starved chicks, and they're surrounded by piles of food, but because there was no female to rip it up into bite-sized pieces, because the male doesn't have the instinct to do that. And so that's kind of fascinating.
Interesting.
So yeah, you do have cases where they do need tiny pieces of meat, and things can go wrong. But for the most part, peregrines kind of figure it out, and they do a really good job of... There have been some challenges. I was reading one account, actually more than one account, of peregrines that have lived in metro areas where they've accidentally fed where they have fed presumably poison pigeon to their brood,
right,
and the chicks died,
right? Because when the bird, I mean, we have this image of the birds regurgitating food for the young. It doesn't go into the stomach and come back, does it? It goes into...
Well, that's for certain species.
Okay.
So not everybody... Different.
Some of them just tear it apart and feed them, and some of them actually regurgitate from the gullet.
Yeah. So in the cases of, like, cardinals and robins that are just gathering up food, they hold it in the crop. And then they just kind of regurgitate
grind
that
it up
back.
So it's digestible.
Well, it's not even really ground up in the crop. It's just like a holding pocket. And then you have the case of mourning doves that will eat the seeds, and then they use that, and it produces a milk in their crop, and the birds and their chicks suck up this milk. But yeah, no, and actually, let's talk about this, because I kind of debated about whether or not to bring this article up.
Oh, let's go. Let's go ahead and go.
All right. And I promise we'll finish it off with something cute. So I came across this in my search for adding news to the Facebook Bird Chicks site. And also because of birding business and things like that, I find myself subscribed to different agricultural magazines, because oftentimes the seed prices kind of pertain to what the seed price is going to be in bird seed. And I found something in Ag Week, which is Agricultural Week, where they're talking about ways to deal with birds. And it's talking about how to control bird damage on, well, in this case, dairy farms. And they're mostly talking about starlings and different ways to deal with that. And they talk about live traps and repellents. And I found this really interesting. Auditory and visual repellents seldom are effective. So think of all the places where you've been where someone is playing like a loud bird call in their yard, or, you know, the fake owl. It's acknowledging in this article, they really don't work. It talks about using the sticky stuff, the tangle foot that you can put down. That stuff is only effective for a year, because after a while, rain and just dust cause the tangle foot to be... just cause it to be ineffective. But they're talking, they say, you know, really the best things to do are bird-proofing your property, you know, sealing up holes, doing things, you know, modifying. Hey, maybe cover up all the feed that the starlings are getting access to that they're stealing from cattle. I found this really fascinating. If you're someone into livestock, one of the best things that you can do is modify the feed size to your animals. Starlings can only swallow something so big.
Okay.
And so this was saying, feed a pellet that is 1.5 inches in diameter and 3 inches long to keep birds from eating the chunks instead of just feeding grains, which I thought, oh, that's actually really good. But then it kind of got into the whole area of using poison, or as they call it, toxicants.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about Avitrol, Starlicide, and something called DRC 1339. And so essentially these are bird poisons that have been approved. And so I thought, I hear a lot of things about whether or not these things involve secondary poisoning. And when you're talking about secondary poisoning, you're talking about, okay, you've had all these starlings, these red-winged blackbirds feeding in this area. Right. You want to get rid of them. You put down some avitrol. The starlings and the red-winged blackbirds eat them. And then they fly away and die. And then something else eats them. And my thinking is usually a hawk or something like that. Will they get poisoning from the poisoning system? So I'm just kind of like, I'm doing some casual Googling to try and find this out. And I find the Avitrol website, which looks very nice with their churches and pigeon photos. And they're like, it's not painful to the birds at all. There are a lot of extremist groups that would like you to think that it's painful. It's like, okay, come on, it's poison. There's going to be some right. pain in there. Let's call a spade a spade. But in the grand scheme of being in the wild, pain, you have to think about things like that. If you want to eliminate something, if you want to kill something, pain is going to be involved. There's just really no easy way to do that. And one of the things you need to keep in mind is that nothing dies easily in the wild, even if you go by natural causes. If you go by starvation, if you go by being killed by a Cooper's hawk where you're eaten alive, or how about if you're killed by a wolf where you don't always die right away? You know, pain is just a fact of life in the wild. So pain with poison. But if poison is going to kill unintended species, or if, let's say, the starling dies and then a Cooper's hawk eats it. So I'm just kind of doing some casual research. And so Avitrol is saying, no, there's no pain and there's not really any secondary poisoning. And if you don't believe us, check out the secondary hazard report that we have here from U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So I'm reading this, and it's just one of those things where I know too much. I don't want to know this. So essentially, U.S. Fish and Wildlife took a bunch of red-winged blackbirds, which I know a lot of you are saying, hey, aren't they protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty? Blackbirds, icterids, you can get depredation permits for them. And it is possible for a farmer in North Dakota that's growing a bunch of sunflowers for birdseed to apply to kill a bunch of blackbirds because they are considered a pest species. So to study some of these poisons, U.S. Fish and Wildlife took a bunch of red-winged blackbirds and fed them birdseed covered in Avitrol. And they all died within 2 hours to 24 hours of eating the Avitrol. Then they froze everybody so that they would have it in their system. And they ground them up and fed them to different things. And I thought, okay, this is going to be hard to read. But I'm curious about what they did. So they fed ground-up red-winged blackbirds for 2 weeks to rats, dogs. One was a beagle. One was a beagle-coyote hybrid. How the heck did that happen? They fed them to magpies, black-billed magpies. They fed them to a Cooper's hawk. No, I'm sorry, not a Cooper's hawk. A sharp-shinned hawk, a red-tailed hawk, and then a European sparrow hawk, just to see if they would be affected by eating this. And they fed them for several days, and like the equivalent of at least one starling a day. Nobody died or showed any symptoms of being poisoned from the red-winged blackbirds that ate this. And so I'm thinking, okay, that's really interesting. And then I got to the part where then the gross necropsy showed, and I was like, oh. So they took, like, these dogs and for 2 weeks fed them ground-up red-winged blackbird with poison. And since they didn't exhibit any symptoms, then they did an autopsy where they just made sure that everything. So essentially, they've done a lot of tests on some really nice animals to prove that Avitrol doesn't do any secondary poisoning. I know too this much. Is...
Okay, so what was the point of these tests?
The tests were to, you know, we're going to poison starlings and red-winged blackbirds, yellow-headed blackbirds, probably some rusty blackbirds, pretty much anything that is, you know, going after these crops, and you can kill all these things with poison fairly effectively. We just want to make sure they're not going to kill anything else that might eat them, like coyotes or hawks. So in order to test that, we're going to use some beagles and a beagle-coyote hybrid and some magpies and some red-tailed hawks and some sharp-shinned hawks. Mm. And it's just, I mean, I get that we need to study this. It's just to actually read it on paper and to read the species and then to realize, oh, you guys ate poison stuff for 2 weeks and then they killed you so they could do a necropsy to make sure, even though you weren't exhibiting, and I get science, but at this point it's right. like, I know the species. I probably know how they got all these animals. So if you're living with some kind of like wolf dog hybrid or coyote hybrid and you're giving it to some facility because you can't handle it anymore, this is the kind of stuff that they
this
go to.
This does not help that our rabbit is currently like poking up from behind our table. Like, what are you guys talking about? Why aren't you giving me food?
And I get that it's a contradiction because I eat animals.
Oh yeah, tonight
we live with an edible animal.
We did. We had tonight for dinner. We had beef marrow.
We had bone marrow.
Yeah.
And I feel good about eating that for a couple of reasons because the grossest part of the animal, the grossest part of the animal is often the tastiest
right.
part.
Yeah.
And secondly, because everybody is always interested in steaks and ground beef,
right.
they're not as interested in the gross part. So that stuff kind of goes to the weight. So I'm happy to eat the stuff that should only be for vultures. But, it's all part of the awkward moment in the contradiction of being a human being. Because I'm dealing with that this week. It's going to be a blog entry soon, but
our rabbit is eating our couch, if you want to get
futon.
Any couch rights, yeah.
Yeah, technically that's suede. So yeah. You're eating cow there, rabbit. I had that awkward... I'm going to make this a blog entry, but I'm just trying a way to do it nicely. I know my family doesn't listen to my podcast, so I can talk about it here, but I had that awkward moment.
Oh, okay, good. Okay.
I had that awkward moment with my very close family members last week where, what do you mean you don't support me doing trap, neuter, and release with a feral cat colony?
Oh, that's what you were going to talk about. Boy, that could have gone in a different direction.
No, it's just, and I'm learning that when I talk to people working with feral cat colonies, that I just can't assume that they're uneducated, crazy people, that they could be my family members who are educated and very well-intentioned and just may not understand how going from this particular point A won't necessarily lead to point B, it'll lead to point Z, which is very bad for a lot of species. And yeah, it was just that awkward moment. And I saw it coming down the pike because I saw some like stuff about trapping kittens. And I thought, I'm not going to say anything. They're well-intentioned. They're just trapping kittens. And then like they released the kittens back outside into a yard. I'm like, why didn't you keep the kittens? I was like, well, I took them out of a neighborhood where people didn't like them, so putting them in my neighborhood is okay, because I do like them. And I was like, if I was your neighbor, I would be so angry right now. Why didn't you keep the kittens? Because the kittens, the feral cat people that I was working with told me that the kittens were, you know, couldn't be socialized. I was like, you can pick up these kittens. You can pet these kittens. They're totally young enough. Anyway, this is a blog entry, not something I should be working out therapy-wise in the podcast, but... Yeah, it's just that whole awkward
no,
moment.
No, please feel free to continue talking.
No.
We're
it's
only at 37 minutes. No, that's great.
So, no, that was the other thing. And that was, yeah. So, yeah, that's going to be really interesting when I go down to visit my family after the intense discussion that we had in the status update on Facebook with the feral cat. It's like, what made you think having a sister who runs a website called Bird Chick that she would be pro-feral cat? No. So anyway,
do we have other news to talk about?
I wanted to talk about 80 stories. We have not talked about, you know, this wouldn't be a problem if you hadn't gone off on your pop culture and tried to turn this into one of your pop culture podcasts.
Oh God, I've got so many stories to talk about.
What story do you have to talk about?
Let's continue with your
I thing. Was just going to talk about something that showed up on Gawker that a lot of people
thank
have
God.
Asked about.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I distracted from our Nature podcast with a Gawker post. Excuse me.
Are you...
What was a certain Miss S seen stepping out in a mini skirt that was too young for her age?
No. But this... Look, a lot of the people who come to my website, they get their bird notions from Gawker and BuzzFeed and Twitter. No, they...
I don't even know where to start with that.
No, they don't know a lot about birds.
A certain blue jay was seen at Club 21 drinking and dancing the night away.
No, people don't know a lot about birds. They see something that makes it to a major website, and they're like, hey, is this true? Is this what's really going on? Or they just send it to me, and they say, oh, did you see this bird story? Which I think is very sweet, that people see bird stories, and they send it to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, essentially, what it is it says, a raven asks humans for help with painful quills after a porcupine attack. And if you watch it, it's this raven sitting on a fence post, and this nice lady wearing gloves is talking to the raven, removing those quills, and the raven is just like, ah! The whole time.
All right. Is this a wild raven, or is this like a feral?
No. I'm thinking this is a wild raven, and they say that it's a wild raven in the thing. But okay. Here's the thing. If you're looking at it, you can clearly see a gape, see at the corners of the beak, right. Can see some light. This is a young raven.
Okay.
This is a raven that is not with its family.
This woman
group.
Is wearing gloves.
Yes, and she's petting the raven because you're a human. That's what you do. I would probably.
I think this is a pet.
Think this is a pet. Because if you listen to her talk, she's talking to it like she doesn't know this bird. She's not calling it a name.
Oh, thanks for including the sound.
I wanted to get the raven yelling at her. There we go. So, what I think happened is, I don't think it necessarily got attacked by a porcupine, because it only has, like, four quills in it.
Uh-huh. You think the woman sucked the quills in?
No. I think it probably maybe got a roadkill porcupine.
Right.
But it's clearly a young raven, because you can see this outline in the corners of its mouth, and that's a gape that young birds have and they all have it. It's part of the whole adult stimulated to feed the young bird type thing. Mm. And so since it's not with its family group, I'm thinking what happened is this raven was understandably in a lot of pain, because you're going to be when you have some porcupines in it, probably really hungry, and is getting to that point where I'm weak, I'm hungry, somebody feed me, I'm just gonna sit here because I don't know what else to do and just make a lot of noise.
Okay.
And people came up to it, and because it's a young raven, it doesn't know to fly away from people.
Okay.
It's like, are you gonna feed me? So anyway, they helped it. If you read some of the backstory on the raven, the people that found the raven say that it was on their back porch the next day, which is... some people are going to want to interpret that as a thank you. I'm going to interpret that as this is a young raven that was in pain, had some people take its pain away, and was like, oh, maybe these people will feed me. Who knows if the raven actually survived after this point? I hope it did, but this is a young raven that's in a lot of pain, and when birds are young and learning to fly, they don't need know to be scared of people. And
this bird is now their spirit animal and will interpret the afterlife for them.
You know what? If that's how you enjoy birds, that's great. I'm not going to agree with that, but if you want to look out and you see that yellow-headed blackbird flying away as a sign of
I'm
your
sorry,
dead
I just
relative,
saw a part of this video where they offered the bird a flower, and the bird just, like, completely ignored it.
Because it's hungry.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'm like, can you give me some meat?
Speaking of something we were talking about earlier, I was listening to the Flophouse, and they were talking about some crummy movie, and Elliot Kalin, who's a writer for The Daily Show, was talking about... this reminds me of a story my friend told me where he saw a lion that had a thorn in his paw, and he took it out, and the lion ate him. So.
That was one of my favorite things that was going around on Facebook for a little while. It showed this guy walking with an elephant through some water. I was talking about how this guy, I think he was raised with this elephant or something like that, and then they got separated, and he's in a zoo 30 years later with his kid. And he's like, oh my gosh, that's the same elephant I knew, and now it's in captivity. And he hops in to go hang with the elephant, and they seem happy, and the elephant is like trumpeting as it sees him and reunites. And then like kind of just grabs him and beats the crap out of him and kills him. And it's like, yeah, animals don't want to be our friend. But it's set up like one of those really great Facebook stories where, you know, you think it's going to be, you know, this reuniting, and it feels so good when it's just really... Polar bears don't want to be our friends. They just want to use our heads as bowling balls and eat the rest of our body.
Yeah.
Was that your story? Your paragraph?
No, it's not.
What's your paragraph?
I told you already. Oh, the other thing I want to mention? No, that's at the end of the podcast. What's the next story?
I was going to talk about foie gras, but I don't have to.
Go ahead.
I don't have a good segue now because we edited that out.
Oh, my pancreas, it's so full because of all the marrow that we ate.
Okay, so if you're a birder, you're probably not into eating foie gras, which is a fatty duck liver. There's been some controversy about it around the country. Please don't do this after I say this, but if you Google foie gras and you put in any animal rights organization, you're going to see some really horrific pictures of ducks and geese being force-fed with a tube. So here's the thing. With foie gras, this is something that became popular over several years because when people would hunt ducks during migration, ducks and geese, they eat a lot of food at that point, and so their livers get very fatty and very flavorful. And being humans that love to eat, we wanted to figure out how to mimic that any time of year when we wanted these. So you have some duck farms where if you're pro-eating animals, this isn't going to, like, mend you out of shape too much, where these ducks have nice lives outside. And then, like, their last week, last 10 days of life, they're really fed a lot of food. Not force-fed. They're just fed a lot of food, extra food, to make their livers fatty. Their body is used for other types of eating. Their feathers are used for things like people's hair or fishing lures or whatever. You know, toddlers in tiara costumes. And, you know, their liver is turned into foie gras. Then you have other places in France and in the United States where people are like, we want as much foie gras as possible. We're not going to wait for the ducks. We're going to, like, as soon as the ducks are mature, we're just going to force feed the crap out of them. And you have kind of an industrial force fed thing. So if you're pro eating animals, if that is something that you do, if you can find foie gras from a artisanal family that is, like, raising the ducks happily and just, you know, just giving them extra food at the end of their life, that's okay. You want to avoid the industrial force-fed ducks. And that's a whole other argument as to whether or not that is painful to ducks when you consider all the things that they eat. And then you consider the ballistic spiral penis that they mate with. But anyway, I have this article from NPR, and it features someone we know, Darren Moskowitz, talking about the whole foie gras thing. So anyway, right. I just thought I would bring that up because we're bird watchers. Some of us eat animals, some of us don't. Foie gras is a growing controversy in this country. It's not something I've ever eaten or really have a desire to eat because there's so many other tasty things to eat. But I found this argument just very interesting and compelling that you can get nice foie gras if that's something that really trips your trigger. But it's getting harder to find in restaurants because
yeah, that's always concerned with. I mean, and, you know, that's it's become a joke on shows like Portlandia about like finding humane versions of if you want to eat meat, how humane can you be? So.
Well, and I had that in France because there was, I ended up eating at this restaurant that was right across the street from my hotel. And my last night there, I told the waiter, I was like, what do you like to eat? And he was pointing me to the foie gras and I said, oh, I don't think I want to eat that tonight. And he's like, oh, you Americans, you complain about, you know, the food being cruel, but you do not know where your own food comes from.
Did he have a pencil thin mustache?
He did not, but that was his accent. I'm actually doing a really good impersonation of him, actually. And I explained to him, I was like, I actually do know where my cow comes from. And I explained to him about our cow share and our pig share. And he's like, oh. Yeah, maybe you just want to eat as a duck and not to, and so, and that was the best duck I ever ate, that roast duck breast that he served me. But, where was I going with this? But anyway, it's something that you should eat. Anyway, there's an article on here from Dara Moskowitz Grumdahl. It's very interesting, talking about foie gras and finding, just making sure you get it from a nice place and not.
Check it out.
Check it out. You know, if it's not something, if you're not into duck liver, don't worry about it.
What's our next story?
That's my last story.
All right. So, okay. Here's the thing. Here's my story. The rest of this story is behind a paywall. So I only have the headline and the first paragraph for you. So this is from the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm going to go to the Wall Street Journal for bird information.
I'm just telling... Well, this isn't bird. This is nature information. So it's from. So this is why I only have the first paragraph for you. The headline is, I'm going to wait till you stop drinking. Go ahead and swallow. Feed the bear experiment draws public safety worry.
Please tell me this is Lynn Rogers.
It's from the byline is from Caroline Porter. Researchers at a Minnesota institute.
Oh no. It is.
Researchers at a Minnesota institute believe that if humans change their behavior towards bears, both bears and humans could live harmoniously. But the experiment, feeding test subjects to gain their trust, could come to an end.
This has got to be the Lynn Rogers thing. Okay, so... If you don't live in Minnesota, maybe you don't know about this. Okay, perhaps you're listening to this podcast, and chances are you have seen this on Facebook. There's a guy who puts a camera in a bear den, Okay. Lily the Bear, we've talked about her before. So we have this guy in Minnesota who has put collars on bears, and you can follow them around, and he's put cameras in the den. And it seems like really good bear research. But here's the problem. In order to put these radio tracking collars on bears, he doesn't just trap the bears. He acclimates them to humans by feeding the bears, hand feeding the bears, and he follows the bears. He gets really close to bears. And on the one hand, you think, okay, this is a researcher doing that. That's not okay. That's okay. But here's the problem. These bears will go into cities and towns, and they're used to getting food from humans. And so there's concern that since he's habituating these bears to humans and food, that these bears could get aggressive. And there's also been an issue of his radio-collared bears are kind of targets for bear hunters. So, you know, with the radio tagging, is he just kind of like, you know, saying, hey, this is a good bear to shoot because you're going to know its whole history and sure. things like that. He also, to my knowledge, has never published any of his work in any scientific publication. He would argue that he publishes his work on social media. And as someone who publishes on social media, I agree that that's a great way to do some general education to the public. But that is not how you...
It's not science.
That's not how you gain your cojones in the science community. That's not how you make your bones. You have to, like, write the papers. You have to get them published and get them peer-reviewed. Anybody can put anything on social media. So I have to believe that this one paragraph you read, because here's the thing, Lynn Rogers, the guy who does this, just got his permit taken away from the DNR, and right. the DNR is saying you have to remove all your transmitters by the end of July in 2013. And he is doing this huge media campaign here in Minnesota to try and get his permit back. Like, he even tried to have a meeting with the governor today, and it just didn't work. And... anyway, I think Lynn Rogers has done a lot to let the world know about what it looks like when a bear is sleeping in its den and gives birth and, you know, has people have an interest in black bears. But as far as doing actual scientific research, I can't say that I disagree with the DNR for taking away his bear permit. Because these are big animals that could hurt people.
All right. Is that the end of our podcast?
I suppose so.
Okay. This is
148.
Bird Chick Podcast number 148. If you have any questions about the stories we've talked about, go to birdchick.com. Look for the podcast archive link. You'll find all the links there under 148. If you have any questions for Sharon, you can talk to her on Twitter where she is at birdchick, or you can email her where she is sharon@birdchick.com. We will be back to tell you more about the bird news in the future. Ta-ta!